Hello, Hartford, and welcome to the Channel 2 Morning Show. Today, our guest is snake trapper Paul Cerrone. Thanks for being here, Paul.
It's my pleasure, little baby bird.
Okay, so you're from Paraguay, and you...
I trap snakes, yes, anacondas. They have a legend of a journey to a sacred lake. First, you pass a waterfall with warrior snakes, then you travel through the land of the Shirishama.
Wow, that's great. So, when a snake...
Is Mateo here? Mateo, let's move the lights.
Wait, what? Who's Mateo?
He was an old friend, and I thought I heard him, but no. Still no Mateo.
Oh, okay. Well, let's take a break.
You know, that's what the anaconda does. It wraps around your body and squeezes you so you can hear all your bones break before you pass away. Ashes to ashes, little baby bird.
Please stop calling me that.
I'm sorry. It's been a long time since I had a woman.
Yeah, I get that.
What? You get what?
Oh, nothing.
Okay, Mateo. Bad science. Did the movie get it right? Bad science. Or will we have to fight?
Hi, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Bad Science. I'm your host, Ethan Edinburgh, and today we're talking about the greatest snake film of all time, Anaconda, 1997.
Oh, I thought it was Snakes on a Plane.
Yeah. Oh, good call. I forgot about that
maybe
one.
Second.
The
second
best
okay, cool.
snake film of all time, Anaconda. With me are two lovely guests. First, a returning guest, Dr. Greg Pauly, the Associate Curator of Herpetology at the LA Natural History Museum. And your book just came out. Last time we talked, we were getting ready for your book.
Yeah.
And now it's out. It's out in the world. It's Wild LA, Explore the Amazing Nature in and around Los Angeles.
And there are some snakes in the book.
Oh,
although
great.
Not as many as I would have liked, but it does
I'm
talk
so
about
sorry
lots
about
of wildlife across Los Angeles. And they,
now I'm going to read the book.
They limited the amount of snakes that are in there.
I'm going to read the book and be like, how many snakes would he have wanted in
oh,
this
way
book?
More. Yeah.
Well, that you can make another book.
We have 101 species accounts in there, and I think off the top of my head, it's like three snakes, which is like, you know, 70 too few.
72 few
That's
snakes.
We have a lot of snakes in L.A.?
Yeah, we have a pretty good diversity. Like, species-wise, we have pretty good diversity in Los Angeles.
Okay.
I mean, Southern California in general is really amazing for snake diversity.
Well, let me introduce you, because I'm sure the audience is confused and rioting in the streets right now. It's Nicole Schreiber. She's a comedian, writer, actress that you know from Roast Battle and Funny Girls and the Getting to Know You podcast.
Yep, Getting to Know You podcast. This is the Jewy voice you're hearing on air. Besides Ethan's Jewy voice, you have this other Jewy voice.
Yeah, in case there wasn't enough Jewy voices on
yes,
this show.
we will be doing an allergy commercial at the end of this podcast.
That's right. So how's it going, Nicole?
It's going. Thanks
Great.
For having me.
No.
I'm very excited about doing this podcast.
Of course. I'm very excited to have you. And I'm also apologetic because I didn't realize that you had a fear of snakes when I asked you to do Anaconda.
You know, I went into when you said Anaconda, I was like, yeah, I'll do that. I bet that's going to be really just terrible to watch and funny.
Yeah.
And as I'm watching it and there's all these snakes, I was like, oh, God, why did I say yes to this one? But it's just so bad. It's great.
Yeah, we were talking briefly before the pod, like, I've seen this movie a bunch of times.
Yeah.
I don't know why. Do you have the same experience?
Yeah, I've seen this movie an embarrassing amount, but
yeah.
Did I rewatch it last night? Absolutely.
Yes,
was I like,
same.
God, this movie is just as bad as the first time I saw it.
I feel like I did something wrong. Like, as somebody who loves snakes, and I haven't seen that movie in 20-something years. I've seen a bunch of other snake movies, like Snakes on a Plane.
Snakes on a Plane. What
yeah.
other snake movies are
great
there?
One.
If you want to see, there's like a prequel to Snakes on a Plane.
Whoa.
Is a thing that's basically Snakes on a Submarine, but it's like 30 years earlier.
Oh,
and it's, I feel like I remember this somehow.
Okay.
It's
I don't know
the
about
title
that.
Of the movie is it's Fer-de-Lance, and the idea is that a bunch of Fer-de-Lances get loose on, I think it's like a U.S. government-sponsored
really
submarine.
Really quick, Fer-de-Lance is a type of snake?
Fer-de-Lance is a type of snake.
Okay.
Venomous
okay,
cool. snake.
Confused
yeah.
about that, too.
Venomous snake, yeah.
It sounds like
a gentleman caller from France, if we're being perfectly honest.
I married a Fer-de-Lance.
If you remember Herb Tarlick from WKRP in Cincinnati, and I'm horrible with names, but the guy who played Herb Tarlick is the lead actor in this sort of bad Snakes on a Submarine
okay.
movie. I think it must be from the late 70s, early 80s.
Okay.
It is.
I love how the guys who wrote Snakes on a Plane were probably like, what's another enclosed vessel
yeah,
that we
can
right.
where people can just experience sheer terror and panic from snakes?
Yeah.
The submarine in the sky.
And how do we pick a name that's way less cool?
Yeah.
For anybody who's out there who's like into like these sort of weird creature feature movies, or anybody who is like really into snakes, they need to see this movie because it is hysterical.
Oh, great.
And it's supposed to be a bunch of Ferta lances that are like running around. And in fact, the actual snakes they use are baby boa constrictors, which are also used in Anaconda.
Oh.
And then the parents of the snakes that get loose on the submarine, if I remember correctly, when they show the parents, it's actually a California king snake and then a corn snake, which are two like really common species in the pet trade. And then somehow those are supposed to produce these like completely different looking vipers.
So is that because the Ferta lance is like too hard to work with? Why wouldn't they use the name?
Yeah, I mean, I don't.
Ferta lance is a real diva.
I mean, is that? I don't know.
I think that when you're making a movie about a bunch of snakes loose on a submarine, that probably your budget is not huge.
Mm. Yeah,
and probably your concern for accuracy is also probably not especially high.
Yeah.
So 30 years ago,
I think these guys aren't exactly fact checking themselves.
Get whatever like snake the neighbor kid from next door has available that you can borrow for the afternoon.
Right.
I think that's how it works.
Where'd you get the snake from? Jimmy. Yeah.
I just have to have it back by Sunday.
He lives in the cul-de-sac. Yeah. His parents didn't mind. They hate the thing. Feed it while you have it. Thanks.
So, yeah, I don't know. I really like this movie. I was excited to rewatch it. Again, I'm not sure why I've seen it so many times. Maybe it was just on TV growing up. Maybe that was the thing.
J-Lo and Ice Cube. Can we all just get to the bottom of the matter? And that is, we want to watch them.
Yes.
We want to watch those two interact.
Yes, they were great. And I think taking the cake, though, Jon Voight.
Jon Voight crushed it so hard on that.
Yes, I was impersonating him the whole time watching the movie.
Yeah.
I could not get enough, like, even when he's not talking, just his face, you know, looking at people that I adored it.
Where did he get that accent from?
Oh, my God. I was joking about that the entire time.
Like,
and it kind of changes a little bit. Yeah. Like, where is he from?
Wait, I don't know what that accent is.
He claims he's from Paraguay.
Right, he does say that.
Which is like, part of that accent ever suggested.
That's not reminiscent of Paraguay at all.
I don't think so.
Central South America.
We should have Googled a Paraguayan. I mean, that's probably way off, but a Paraguayan accent, because
yes.
I that does not sound. That sounds like no country.
Well, they're in Brazil, right? But nobody ever speaks Portuguese in the entire movie.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
All a bunch of people speaking Spanish.
Yeah. Mateo speaks Spanish.
But, yeah. Mateo speaks
Spanish?
He does randomly speak Spanish.
He's speaking Spanish.
Not really to anyone. He's just.
And
like,
then J-Lo was like, can you understand? And she's like, yeah. I was like, obviously you can't. You're not speaking any language back to him. I don't know what you're doing.
Yeah. So, yeah, before we get into like Super Snake Land, do you guys have favorite parts of the movie? Because I have several. There's like great quotes. And there's great action sequences, so I wanted to turn it over to you guys as like just memorable moments from Anaconda.
Memorable moments when they gave the guy a trach.
Oh my god, so brutal.
Brutal.
Right?
Emergency tracheotomy. With like the most disgusting knife they could possibly.
He goes, give me some alcohol, and I'm thinking rubbing alcohol. Somebody pulls out booze to sterilize it.
He says it off screen too. He's like, I have some whiskey in my flask.
And I'm like, by the way, and what did he pull out to make the trach?
It was a Bic pen.
It was a Bic pen.
Really?
Yeah. It was one of those. It was like the clear plastic Bic pens, which is like a, you know,
you could use that to make an emergency trach. You could use that.
Okay. Pre-med, Nicole Sharp.
Pre-med, yes, you could. You could use that. But for me, I was like, the fact that the guy at some point gets up later on is like, fine. By the way, that guy would be dead from infection.
Yes, definitely.
You're on the what's the river we're on in this?
It was on some tributary of the Amazon.
Yeah, so you're in the Amazon. The amount of bugs and
man.
Things that'll
diseases
kill you
in the air,
floating
probably.
Around.
Yeah.
And that water, they're just in and out of that water
all the time.
Like Ice Cube's leg, by you're dying of some sort of sepsis from that. He got stabbed in the leg. You're done.
Big time.
You're not getting
the knife. The knife they use for the tracheotomy. Like if you remember, like Ice Cube at one point is actually playing with this perfectly clean Spyderco knife, right?
Yeah.
Like there's the knife to use, but they grab a knife that I think they'd been like descaling a fish with.
Yeah. The fish
and it's
knife.
Like, it is covered. It's absolutely covered
fish
with like guts and ooze. It's like completely gross. And then they shove this into this guy's trachea.
I will say,
he'll be fine. No problem. With no antibiotics for multiple days.
Eric Stoltz.
Yeah.
What a dreamboat. I forgot how cute he was.
I feel like they built him up as like way more of a dreamboat than he actually is. Like he's this like all American perfect dude.
Yeah.
Which don't get me wrong. He's an attractive man and all that stuff. But I love how they just took him out of the movie.
Yeah. I mean, he basically lies in a bed for the entire
90% of the film. Yeah. Which I thought was just hilarious. I love that because his entrance is like, oh, I'm leading this expedition. Yeah. I know what the fuck is up and I'm going to take this guy down. Like he starts like butting heads with John Voight's character. I can't even remember his name. Oh, Paul.
Yeah. Paul, yeah.
Serrano or
Paul Serrano, something like
something
that.
Something like that. Which sounds very
Paradwayan. We're going to say John Voight because we don't remember
John Voight, that's fine.
His right. So
he's nor like, do I remember most of. I mean, it's such an amazing cast.
Yes.
Owen Wilson?
Yeah, Owen Wilson.
Gary. I know his name's Gary because Paul says it a lot. John Voight keeps saying.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Gary.
Yeah. But get the lights, Gary.
By the way, one of my favorite things was when John Voight did the move where he slides up the pole and just like jiu-jitsus and like wraps his leg around that girl's neck and then just strangles her to death. And he's like, night, night, birdie, or something like that.
Yeah, little bird.
Little bird. And I was like, whoa, very accurate.
Yeah, that was a sweet move.
Yeah.
And, the actor we're leaving out, and I totally forgot this because it's been so long since I've seen the movie, but this is somebody I'm a huge fan of, and I couldn't believe I didn't know this, but Danny Trejo.
In the beginning, the first guy who blows his brains out in the beginning.
Yeah, yes, commits suicide like 45 seconds into the movie. And I was like, how did I not know?
He looks
I feel like I should go have one of his donuts or like one of his tacos in honor of Trejo.
Let's go.
I just didn't remember he was in this.
Yeah.
And
he's one of like seven people in this movie, by the way.
I can't believe they didn't have him in it more. I feel like he would have been a better boat captain than the other dude.
Oh, 1,000% he should have been Mateo.
What a boring actor. That guy had no depth.
Nothing going on with Mateo.
You've got to throw in a couple of these actors that like you know from 10 seconds into the movie that person's
going into a snake.
There's a certain number of people you have to know like, oh, they're dead.
Yeah.
So I was actually surprised how long he stuck around before he got eaten.
I mean, the movie made a bunch of money, but I feel like it would have made a little bit more if we had Trejo as Mateo.
Trejo is Mateo. That's
Hashtag Trejo is Mateo.
Did the movie make a lot of money?
It did make a lot of money.
Really?
The budget was like 45 mil, and I think it made like 150 something mil.
Wow.
I know.
It's because of J-Lo and Ice Cube.
I know. Yeah, a lot of power there.
And,
celeb
I mean,
power.
John Voight. I mean, he's
yeah, like, he kills. He really does great in the film. Really, and I think everybody wanted
to. He's a serious villain.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he's a serious actor. The dude's...
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
The dude's the real deal. Like, of everyone on that set, he was like...
Yeah.
Swinging the biggest dick for sure.
Especially at that time, right?
At that time,
like,
definitely.
Even at that time, like, Danny Trejo becomes much more popular immediately after that. I mean...
What year was this film?
97.
And then From Dusk Till Dawn, which I think is...
Right.
I mean, he'd been in the movie, in the acting business for a long time before that. But, like, that was, to me, it's kind of the movie where, like, he became... really well known following that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
And, you know, that was probably filmed right around the same time that Anaconda was filmed. You know, they come out a year apart.
Yeah.
John Voight was the big name at the time.
Yeah, and he stole the film for me. I think everybody did great. I'm not trying to like take anything away from Ice Cube or J-Lo. Like everybody was fine, but every second that he's making faces and his little lines of
J-Lo was basically playing herself. By the way, terrible actor. She's definitely gotten better since then, but like the acting was so bad, I wanted to gouge my eyes out.
I don't think this is like a multi-cut sort of film shoot. You know,
Ice Cube was great though. Ice Cube was just playing himself.
Yes. Yeah. Also playing himself.
Nailed it.
But
John Voight really brought, like, I think when John Voight signed on to do that movie, he was like, do I have anything in my schedule? I have literally nothing in my schedule. All right, cool. Are we going to some hot area where I'm going to get a tan? Great. I'll go there. That's it.
Yeah.
That's the only reason he took that movie. He had literally nothing else to do.
One of my favorite parts is when that dude, I can't remember his name, the British guy.
The guy who's supposed to be narrating the documentary.
The guy who's golfing on the boat whole time.
All the time.
I love how they're like, at times they're like, oh, we're so concerned about the ecosystem. And then at other times he's just shooting golf balls right off into the river.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah,
so he is Whitridge. It's something like that, right?
Whitberg. No, he's not a berg.
I wish. Well, let's call him Whit. So he is trying to escape the snake at one point and climbs up into a waterfall. Yeah. And then the snake is like looking for him. I have so many questions about this part, Greg. But so the snake is like going up and puts his head into the waterfall, sees him. And then to try to escape, he jumps out. And then midair, the snake like snatches him by the face and wraps him up. And
that's all totally realistic.
Yeah, okay, great.
No doubt.
By the way, the face snatching. The snake is snatching everybody by the face.
Yes.
Yeah.
Goes right.
So the honest answer is that no, there's nothing in that entire sequence. That entire sequence is all completely bogus.
Right.
So
sure.
I don't even know where to start. There's so many things that are wrong. Since we mentioned the face snatching, repeatedly in this movie, the anaconda bites people like in the head
or the shoulder
or shoulder or torso or something, right? So that basically, if you look at the cases of big snakes, which of course are never as big as that are shown in this movie, but if you look at the cases of big snakes actually having predatory bites on humans, those bites are usually below the waist.
Yeah.
So like calf is
closer to the ground or water because that's where they're at.
And these are huge animals. It's not like they can easily pick large amounts of mass up off the ground. And so they're going to bite. And if they were up high off the ground, you would see them. So like if it's like an anaconda, which is mostly an aquatic animal anyway, if it's an anaconda and it's in like a marsh, it's underwater.
Yeah.
Well, here's one of the things that they said in the explanation of the anaconda is that it's like a heat seeking.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Also, that part's not true.
That I was like, God. Why include that? I don't think that didn't sound accurate at all.
So it's not. So boas and pythons, and an anaconda is basically in the family Boidae, so it's one of the boas. Mm-hmm. And of course, pit vipers all have these pits on their face that allow them to sense thermal signatures. So they're sensing infrared. So like boa constrictors have that, for example. Rattlesnakes in our area have that, for example. But it turns out, although anacondas are boids, they actually don't have those heat-sensing pits, which kind of makes a little bit of sense. Like, if you're mostly an aquatic animal and you're swimming around in kind of murky water,
you're not
probably don't
want to
have,
register.
Like, a bunch of, like, openings on the front of your face that are getting full of silt and dirt and so forth. So
that makes sense.
And you're also probably, at least for things like fish, they're the same temperature as the background, so it's not doing you any good. Mm. So anacondas actually don't have those heat-sensing pits, whereas lots of other boid species do.
Uh-huh.
And so they took that information, like, you know, general information about boids, and then just sort of threw it in there anyway, even though it's
based in some sort of fact.
Yeah, it's not completely... Nice.
You know,
it's not completely out there.
Super accurate.
Okay. Yeah. So, but it's not way
out there. So they're also, it's an anaconda. It's not a species. You know, this is the world's most massive snake, right? These things achieve the largest weights of any snake species.
So the size of the snakes that were in the film
were ridiculous.
They'll never be that big.
Yeah. So like what those snakes are like, the opening paragraph is this like beautiful opening paragraph, right? That comes across the screen and it says like, they're enormous, they're ferocious, they reach 40 feet long.
Right.
None of these things are true.
Right.
Like the actual like size records are like half that. So.
Yeah. I saw that they're usually like 17 feet and the largest that were ever found was like 25 feet. But there's like a lot of controversy about this.
Yeah.
There's like tons of reports, but they're not validated.
Exactly. So there's lots. I mean, it's also. So you would think like how hard could it be to measure. Like,
yeah, get a bunch of rulers together.
Yeah,
and that's
just
it.
Like take a steel tape measure, go
from
the tip of the snout.
You're like, hey, guy, hold still.
Yeah.
But if it's alive, it's not like it's cooperating with you.
Yeah.
So it's, you basically need the animal to be dead. And then, you know, you need to sort of have some way to like reliably measure it when that animal is dead.
Yeah.
And the reality is like most of these cases that are claiming something like 25 feet, 24 feet, 26 feet, there's a few like ridiculous cases that are trying to claim over 30 feet. There's no solid documentation that that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
And so, this best study is by this guy, Jesus Rivas, who in the late 90s and early 2000s was measuring huge numbers of green anacondas on the Llanos of Venezuela. And
was
he
catching them?
Yeah, he was catching them. I mean, caught hundreds of them.
How do you catch a fucking snake that big?
Yeah,
I think carefully would be the
sure.
But
right
for
word.
Real, though, what, do you,
like
what do you do?
So it turns out that, I mean, these anacondas, like, you know, they're not crazy aggressive. So they want to be in the water.
Totally
so
the opposite.
Basically,
killing a monkey and bait catching
the
monkey?
Did not use that technique. No, they wandered around in areas where they occur looking for anacondas, you know, walking around barefoot in like marshy habitats.
Still sounds like a dangerous game.
Yeah. Oh, God.
And in fact, they actually published a paper from that work. Two of Jesus Rivas's field assistants were actually involved in potential predatory attempt. So two people were struck at by anacondas.
Struck at.
So in one case, they actually realized what was happening before the snake struck. So it looked like the snake was sort of following the field assistant for something like, say, 7-8 feet, tongue flicking a lot, so sensing the environment around it, possibly trying to estimate how big this prey item was to figure out whether it was something it could go after. And at that point, you know, Jesus was able to, you know, realize what was going on. There was a photographer who actually had a photographic sequence of this. And Jesus kind of grabbed the snake right as the snake sort of lunged at the person and the person was jumping backwards. So the snake actually didn't get off a full strike and the person got away.
Okay, so the anaconda kills by biting?
So it's going to bite something.
It's a stun.
And then it is a constrictor. It's going to wrap a couple of coils around it. And you see that. That's actually, you do see that in the movie. It's going to wrap a couple of coils around it, and it's going to try to basically suffocate.
Squeeze
it to death is actually a better way to say it, because the actual ways in which the prey item dies are usually, like, diverse.
Yeah.
So it could be, like, if you're in water, what you actually probably die from is drowning.
Yeah.
Damn.
If you're not in water, like, you know, you tried to jump out of a waterfall to escape a snake and the snake grabbed you from a tree, you know, you're not going to drown necessarily.
But it'll, like, break your bones.
Then what's
going to
happen, is it's going to constrict.
Yeah.
And so you have lots of potential things that are going to happen. You can die of a stroke because your blood pressure, particularly in your veins, is going to skyrocket. So possibly you're going to have, like, an aneurysm, stroke out. You're also going to have lack of oxygenated blood flowing through your body. So, you know, you have all this, like, circulatory arrest, potential stroke. You have all these potential things going on.
Uh-huh.
You have bones potentially getting crushed.
Uh-huh.
So there's, like, numerous ways that this whole
body
act of being
that.
Sort of scrunched.
But I
want
to go back for one second. You're saying that he saw that the snake was attacking somebody and he grabbed it?
Yeah. So then they grabbed it so that it couldn't have this full strike. And then, you know, they worked up that animal. They actually did, you know, they did measure that animal. They tried to get a length measurement.
What do they do with its fucking head?
Right. That's what I was going to say.
Wait, isn't that snake strong enough that it's going to coil up?
Yeah, in this case, they had several people there, and so they're able to sort of wrestle around with the snake. And it's going to get tired relatively quickly. Remember that these are these anacondas are massive animals. And so they're so big that actually they're not very mobile on land. And so at least
part of the film then, right?
Because that thing was flying. Anacondas are not arboreal. They're not climbing up into trees. They're not moving quickly on land. They certainly are great. They're great swimmers.
Are their scales different than other snakes that are land-dwelling snakes?
Not especially. So like sea snakes, for example, there are some sea snakes that have these really modified bodies that allow them, that are kind of like the whole body becomes kind of fin-like, and they're able to then propel themselves really well in water. And we're not seeing that. Like, an anaconda is still kind of like, you know, sort of your typical kind of snake build. It's just really big.
Yeah.
But they're still able to move pretty well in water. But on land, that's just a huge amount of bulk to be moving around.
Yeah.
And so they're not incredibly quick.
Wow.
At least over
like
longer distances.
One of those things where it's like
land.
When you're in outer space for a long time, your bones aren't used to like bearing full weight.
Right.
And so I'm sure snakes, like, they feel like light and airy in the water. And then when they get to the land, they're like, oh, my body is really heavy.
Yeah. I mean, it's just a lot of, that's a lot of mass that they're moving around. And so they're not incredibly mobile on land. So,
okay. Yeah. Would not think
but
that.
But certainly they're great swimmers in the water.
Yeah.
And they want to spend their time in the water. But if you start, you know, if there's three, you know, adults messing around with, you know, something like that particular one that struck was, my recollection is something like 5.5 meters. So, you know, this is not a tiny snake.
Yeah.
You know, but it's still going to tire out pretty quickly with sort of wrestling around with these people. And so they're able to basically grab it right behind the head. Sort of once that head is secure, then you can kind of go ahead and try to take your measurements, which even then are going to be relatively, you know, if you like measured repeatedly, you'd probably find that there's like, you know, 10, 15, 20% error because it's just hard to take measurements on this animal that's kind of moving around.
Right.
Now,
right.
The snake, the anaconda, the bite from the anaconda, it releases venom?
Nope, no venom. Not
so the
bite is to secure that thing from running away. So they're going to bite it and then they're going to wrap their coils around it.
But the bite won't kill you. The bite won't do anything.
No, the bite, I mean, as you pointed out earlier, the bite's probably going to kill you if you're like, you know, in murky water, don't have access to antibiotics.
It's like
you
the infection will kill you.
The infection might kill you, you know, days later.
And they have teeth that will get down in you or how?
Yeah, so I mean, it's, you know, they've got pretty long teeth. A big chunk of their prey items are going to be things like capybara as well as fish. And so you've got to have teeth that are like, gonna be able to grip something that has like, you know, relatively thick sort of fish scales. Mm. And you also want to have teeth that are gonna get through the fur of something like a capybara and actually, you know, be able to get some grip on the actual body of the animal. So they've got teeth. If it bites it's gonna hurt. You know, you're gonna be bleeding.
Yeah.
But the real problem is that keeps you from running away, and then it's gonna wrap a couple coils around you, and you know,
dunzo.
Exactly. Yeah. And then,
what do you do if it starts wrapping its coils around you? Is there anything, or you're done for?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, for an adult. So first of all, like, let's be clear with anacondas. There's not a single documented case of a human fatality as a result of an anaconda.
So that thing that we saw on the internet where they opened up a snake and there was the body of a villager in it.
Yeah. So that's a real. That is real.
Oh.
That is a real incident.
Okay.
That is a different species of snake. So that's a reticulated python,
which is
the world's longest species of snake. So, like,
oh, wait a minute.
Why didn't they make reticulated
So there are. There's a whole another set of movies called Python that are based on reticulated Python. Yeah. So and then there's eventually there's I think there's even one that's like Anaconda versus Python, and there's Python versus
Freddy versus a bunch of other Jason stuff.
Anaconda
versus Anaconda versus Python.
And so there are these reticulated pythons. Like documented 24, 25 feet long.
So wait a minute. I thought the green anaconda was the longest snake.
Green anaconda is the largest snake based on mass.
Oh,
so it's the fatty tuna.
It is probably number two on length. There's actually some debate about that because there's so much speculation about, you know, was the snake 24 feet? Was it 25 feet?
How big
were they? Uh-huh. And so
comparable length, but the anaconda is a thicker mama.
Much more massive animal. So
THICC.
Reticulated pythons, which do get a little bit bigger, and actually can be arboreal. So that's actually, like, if they wanted to have these scenes with, like, something
climbing
around
a tree,
a waterfall, or climbing into a tree, like, a reticulated python would totally have been realistic.
Okay.
So they could have just shifted to be in Southeast Asia, and they could have focused on reticulated. And they are, reticulated pythons are known for having taken out people. In that video that sort of went viral on the internet a couple of years ago of one being opened up and finding a human body inside, that was real.
Yeah.
Damn.
So,
how long does the digestive process of a snake take?
So it's going to vary based upon the size of the prey.
Oh, wait, really quick. Rewind. Hold that. Put a pin in that. At some point in the movie, someone said, or maybe the caption said that they play with their prey. Anaconda plays with their prey.
Yeah. Yeah. This is that opening paragraph. It's ferocious. It's enormous. They get 40 feet long. And you're like, no, no, no. And then the next sentence of that opening paragraph is, I actually wrote it down because it was so absurd. They will regurgitate their prey in order to kill and eat again.
Yeah.
Right.
And it's like, okay, first of all, like when you read that line, you're like, okay, that's completely absurd. That makes no sense for a whole variety of reasons. But then like, this is awesome because you know that at some point in the movie, it's going to regurgitate some human. And
when John
Voight
got regurgitated and winked at her, I was like, get the fuck out of here. Go
what? And that was the best because you're like, you know something's going to get regurgitated. And then I watched that scene where John Voight gets regurgitated. And then I'm like, wait, did he wink? Yeah. Like, he's dead.
Totally.
Why is he winking? Like, he's dead.
Because the filmmakers were like, how awesome would it be?
How dead was he? Not dead enough.
We don't know.
So that was such a great scene. So... But totally absurd, right? Like, why would a snake go through all of this incredible energy expenditure and putting itself at risk?
Uh-huh. Yeah, yeah.
You know, you take out a large prey item, like, you're putting yourself at risk. Like, you might lose an eye, you know.
How you're getting into the psychology of a snake. It's exhausting.
Yeah, I mean, it is physically exhausting, but it's also, like, a really risky thing.
Put it in your scales.
Like, if you're eating, like, so anacondas eat caiman, for example. Like, if you're taking out a caiman and you don't secure a bite and get that thing wrapped up quickly, and it gets a couple of chomps into you, like...
Yeah.
That's an issue, right?
Right, that's sure.
And if that's a chomp into your eye, like,
dude,
you
I'll
might
watch
lose
caimans.
An eye.
Oh, they're killing machines.
So, like, these are things that, like, they have to, you know, that's like something that they would legitimately
be concerned
about.
So they don't barf up? That doesn't happen?
And then, once you get this thing down, and also let's think about, like, the way
By the way, do any snakes regurgitate?
So, yes, many snakes will occasionally regurgitate in a very specific set of conditions. So I'll get to those in just a second.
They're on a roller coaster.
Okay. Yeah,
exactly. All right, all right.
Yeah, after an earthquake, they drank too much.
Yeah, they drank too much.
Pregnant.
Yeah, that'll do it. So if you think about like the way snakes eat, they mostly eat things head first, right? So like let's say you eat something like a capybara. Well, a capybara has kind of pointy hooves, right? So you get this thing, or whatever, pointy feet. And so you get this thing down, and then you think about trying to regurgitate that. Well, those, like, first of all, that hair that is all laid down nicely because you ate it head first is now going to, like, as you try to regurgitate it, it's going to be poking the insides of your digestive tract.
The grain.
And those feet and limbs and other things. Let's say it's a bird. Well, then all the bird feathers are going to be, poking against. Or let's say it's some animal that's got, like, serious claws on its feet, right?
Sure.
That's going to be catching on your digestive lining as you try to regurgitate this.
Yeah.
Let's say it's something like an African rock python and it actually eats like an antelope. Well, now you've eaten something that's got like
horns.
Yeah, how does that happen?
How do you regurgitate that? Like, there's only one way that these things can go down. So in general, like, no.
So a snake will consume something with giant horns like that and their body will break that down.
Oh, yeah.
How long does it take? And digest
all of it. Like, when a snake, and they actually
efficient.
They actually allude to this in the movie. So at one point they like pick up some some
dust,
gray
the dust, yeah, yeah, and they're like, that's what's left.
It's just ash. That's all that's left. It's not ash, but their digestive system is so incredibly efficient that it actually will break down bone. And so when they defecate, you basically get sort of two things, right? You get the actual, like,
chunk of doo-doo.
The doo-doo chunk,
poopy,
which is like, looks like poop. It's brown and looks like poop. And there might be things like hair in it, but not much. And there's not going to be bone. And then you get this, you get their nitrogenous waste. So basically, like, the way that, you know, when we pee, what we're getting rid of is we're getting rid of our nitrogenous waste. But when reptiles do that, and just think about this with a bird, and of course birds are reptiles, what do you end up with, like, on your car? You end up with that sort of white, gross kind of pasty thing. Well, most snakes are much more concerned about not losing a lot of water. And so they actually dry that way down into this sort of white, nitrogenous, sort of uric acid kind of ball.
So that's what that was?
And so, and when that sort of decomposes over a year or two, it just turns into like a white dust.
Oh,
so like, actually, that wasn't totally absurd. But yeah, they fully digest all of this. And so when it comes out the other end, and it can take... I think you asked how long it takes.
Metabolic process,
Like, if it's a big snake and it eats a huge prey item... it might be something like a couple of weeks.
So that'll sustain a snake for a couple of weeks.
Oh, no, that'll sustain a snake for months and months and months.
Wow.
But they might poop it out within a couple of weeks. They've already sort of accumulated as much of that energy.
So they just don't eat for a few months because they're they're good.
So if, like, if an anaconda, let's say an anaconda, like, let's say it's a big anaconda, and like, okay, a big anaconda is not...
Let's say it's a 17-foot anaconda.
Let's say it's a 17-foot, 200-pound anaconda. And in that study we were talking about, that study led by Jesus Rivas and the Llanos of Venezuela, the biggest snake they documented was something like 17.1 feet and 215 pounds. But let's say a 215-pound snake eats a 100-pound capybara. So I don't know. Is that now a 315-pound snake? Like,
yeah.
But then it's going to poop, and it's going to be back to being a 220-pound snake.
I mean, I weigh myself before and after every poop, and that sounds
about
right.
Makes a difference, right?
Yeah.
So now let's say it eats something like that big capybara. A huge capybara like that, that might last it 6-8 months.
Wow.
Yeah.
And now, is it hungry in that time?
Yeah, so, I mean, that's, you know, it's hard for us to know, like, what a, like, snake is feeling.
You don't talk to snakes?
Yeah, I mean, I eat, even if I'm completely full, I'll still keep eating.
Yeah, because, same, because it's awesome.
Yeah, because that's just what I do.
It's fun. And are they pooping the whole time? Or is it one big poop? And
yeah, so this actually is sort of interesting, too. Like, an anaconda, I don't know the... So in some species of snakes, people have actually looked at the rate at which prey items pass through. And so oftentimes it's, like, really short, right? Like, so anybody who owns a pet snake sort of knows, like, you know, you feed it a couple mice and, like, 6-8 days later, like, there's a poop, right? There's the mice coming out the other end. And so
does it come out mice-like?
Oh, no, it looks like poop.
Okay, good, good. Okay.
Yeah. Although drier and less smelly than, like, human poop. You know, humans have really fairly good access to water, so we don't have the necessity of, like, trying to prevent water loss.
There's
a lot of snakes do. And so their poops tend to be much, much drier. But with these... no, I totally got sidetracked here.
How often they poop?
So what we know in some species of snakes, and this is particularly in vipers... what people have done is they've taken little plastic beads and attached plastic beads to the mice, like colored beads.
Whoa.
And then they can actually see, like, when does that bead come out end, right, in a captive animal. And what we know is that in some cases, vipers will retain these, like, food boluses, these former prey items, in their digestive tract for extremely long periods of time, like maybe something like a year.
Wow.
In the thought.
But is that maybe perhaps they're not passing the bead? Maybe they already
passed exactly.
The item.
No, that's
so
right. But
that.
Like, but this... Yeah, you might say, well, like, maybe somehow the plastic, but this is a little tiny plastic bead, like the kind of thing that you would, like, you know, put a
like
sewing
a
needle
bracelet.
Through, like on a little bracelet.
Yeah.
Like, why would that suddenly go at a different speed through the digestive tract than, like, the rest of the mouse, right?
I mean, perhaps, like, the digestive lining, it adheres to the digestive lining.
But it's,
like, okay.
But it's like, you, there's nothing, like,
it's
super
obvious,
right?
This isn't 100%
right?
accurate.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, we're putting a plastic bead through the digestive tract of a snake. Like, we're doing, you know.
Yeah.
This is pretty unique science here. So what we see, though, is that in some vipers, they actually retain, they seem to retain parts of that prey item for incredibly long periods of time. And the thought is that maybe this is basically, like, used as ballast. So they're kind of, like, weighting down the back end of their body. And maybe this is, like, allows them to sort of have the back end of their body kind of anchored with some mass, and therefore allowing the front end of the body to then be thrown forward during their predatory strikes.
That makes sense.
That's the thought. But this is only sort of
bottom
figured out
heavy.
Like 15 years ago. And I don't think anyone's looked at this in anacondas, like whether or not they do this. But we know that in parts of the range of the anaconda that they go through dry seasons. And so if they get something like a big capybara, they might you know, hole up somewhere where there's a little bit of moisture, but maybe not much access to food. And they might go 6, 8, 10 months without eating, you know, through some of these dry periods.
Crazy.
I feel like there's a lot of animals that do that sort of thing where they
hibernate,
food storage
type move.
You know, you just got to think about it, right? I mean, this is a snake. And so they're getting lots of, you know, they're thermoregulating, right? Like their metabolism isn't cranking all the time like ours is. Like our metabolism is going through huge amounts of, you know, energy is just burning through calories because it's trying to keep us, you know, roughly at 98.6 degrees, right? Mm-hmm. Well, a snake is like, I'm not going to bother with that. That's ridiculous. So I'm going to use the environment to thermoregulate. You know, if I'm cold, then I stick a coil out into the sunshine. If I'm too hot, I move into the shade.
Yeah.
And so they don't have to burn through all these calories, mm-hmm. right? And so as a result, they don't have to take anywhere near the amount of food that we do. So something like a big meal a couple times a year, you're good to go.
So that's another bullcrap part of the movie is that he eats somebody and then he's like, I'm starving.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess if you want to make a scary predator, if you want to have a snake be a scary predator, then you've got to have it be in the situation where like it's going to keep eating.
Right. Or there's a bunch of snakes.
So this is where
I wish they had talked to a herpetologist because like there were so many cool things they could have done. Mm-hmm. Like, this is one of these, this is often the case in these sorts of movies where like the actual reality is way better than some of the stuff that people imagine. And so like we know that during mating season, like female anacondas often end up in these mating balls where you have multiple males.
Yes.
All going after
about
a female.
So, I had no idea about that.
Why not have them come across? Like, you don't need one snake to take out seven people. You could just have seven snakes take out seven people.
Yeah, and that's
like,
way
that
scarier,
would have been
too.
Way cooler.
Yes.
Wait a minute. So it's a bunch of snakes trying to get with the lady snake?
Yeah, it's a bunch of males all going after the same female. Yeah.
I feel like that's a common theme in the animal kingdom.
Yeah, I think it's not necessarily isolated to snakes.
Yeah.
I wrote it down. I read that like they put out some sort of like pheromone or something that the males pick up on, and so they
This is starting to sound like snakes on a plane now.
Yeah.
They all get to the same female, and then like you're saying, they like wrap into this ball because they're all trying to mate with her.
Yeah.
But they'll just stay there for like a long period of time.
Yeah. With the idea, well, there's lots of things that are so there's this varies by species of snakes, right?
Okay.
And there's lots of things that are going on. And there's probably there's a ton of stuff that we still don't know very much about. Like, there's these garter snakes, for example, that in the northern end of the range of these garter snakes, it's actually up in like central Canada.
Okay.
So there's these snake dens in places like Manitoba where you might get something like 10,000 garter snakes coming out of a single sort of hibernaculum, right?
Whoa.
So there's literally like a carpet of these snakes cruising around.
Oh,
and so one of the thoughts is that these females, there's actually females that, you know, are giving off pheromones that saying they're ready to mate.
Okay, so, and so reptiles are pheromonal creatures?
Yeah, and way more than we have, you know,
okay.
We barely have scratched the surface of understanding this. But like, you look at things like lizards have these femoral pores, like on the underside of their legs, they have all these pores that are exuding these sort of waxy secretions, mm-hmm. much bigger in males than in females. We don't really have any understanding, like what's the level of communication going on there in terms
and
of.
And is it the same thing? Because I know in the animal kingdom, there's that protein within pheromones that prevents like incest, like an animal of a related animal won't want to procreate with another animal.
It's really like we have barely scratched the surface of understanding things like what we call kin recognition. So how do things recognize that they're
I thought kin recognition was because of the protein.
Well, it just varies by species, right?
Okay.
And in some cases we might have some ideas, and in some cases we might have no idea. But we know that like things like there's like cannibalistic morphs in certain tadpole species, like there's cannibals and then there's non-cannibals, and we know that in some cases the cannibals recognize their kin, like, but we don't know necessarily how they're doing that in all cases. So, yeah, there's just like tons of weird.
And snakes will do that sometimes too, right?
These snakes
can eat each other.
Oh yeah, there's lots of snakes that eat other snakes.
Wow.
That doesn't necessarily mean that there's a high level of cannibalism. There is certainly some cannibalism, but what we tend to see more is like, you know, king cobras eating other species of snakes or king snakes eating other species of snakes.
So interspecies.
Yeah, so you see a lot more of that than you see necessarily with cannibalism, but certainly cannibalism occurs.
Okay.
But yeah, so going back to this idea of like, you know, you get these big snake dens, and some of the females, we think what they're actually doing is like they're actually, because they're having all this activity from these males, is that it's actually warming them up early in the spring season, you know, here at the northern limits of the range. There's actually males that give off pheromones that also confuse some males into thinking that they're females as well. So maybe that's helping them to warm up faster.
Interesting.
So there's like there's so many things going on in these mating balls. There's also just sort of the straight idea of like all the males are kind of wrestling and competing to get access to the female.
Right.
Could also be that we have what's called mate guarding, which is like one male does mate and then that male sticks around to try to make sure that other males don't have an opportunity to mate.
Yeah. Whoa.
So it just, there's a ton of stuff that could be going on. Just
we just don't know.
And we just don't know. Yeah.
Wow. And are they, do we know if they are sensing these pheromones with their tongue? Is that part of that whole?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What's the pheromone receptor?
Yeah, exactly. So it's what people would call the vomeronasal organ or the Jacobson's organ, and which is basically what they're doing when they're sticking their tongue out is they're basically drawing in air molecules, and then they're basically tasting, they're sensing those air molecules and using that to get an understanding of what's going on in the environment around them.
Okay.
And so absolutely, that's they're
getting
those.
Some male snake is like, girl, you tasty.
So you're seeing,
I haven't even tasted you, but your air molecules are delicious.
Yeah. And from a distance. So like I was in a field once up in Northern California looking for one species of snake, and I came across these garter snakes, and it was this big female garter snake, and she kind of, I just was kind of watching her move through the grass, and she actually basically came right up to me and then like kind of realized, oh, big scary human, and I'm out of here, and sort of took off to get away. And like 5 seconds later, here comes a male following the exact track, same thing, came up, tongue flicked. And so, and you'll see this, we actually, what snake biologists do is we actually count the frequency of tongue flicks, we count that tongue flick rate. And that's a way, that's a sort of like a way of judging interest. And so you can do that for like trying to assess like what seems to be the most appealing in terms of potential prey items. But you can also watch snakes tongue flick as they're trying to, like male snakes trying to track down a female.
Okay.
And so absolutely, like, you know, you can watch, as I did in this day in this field in Northern California, you can watch these male snakes and they are clearly picking up the scent of that female, and they are using that to track where that female has moved.
Wow.
And you absolutely see that, you know.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Hey everyone, this is Jesse David Fox, host of Good One, a podcast about jokes. I am proud to announce that I have personally won the Streaming Wars. And there's a new docu-special on Peacock based on our own Vulture podcast. Good One, a show about jokes, follows Mike Birbiglia as he develops new material, taking audiences through the process of transforming personal stories into stand-up. Featuring interviews with Mike's family and comedy colleagues like Seth Meyers, Hasan Minhaj, and Asko Akatsuka, Good One, a show about jokes, is streaming now only on Peacock.
The break is over. Here we go back to the show about science.
You get, I mean, I would be so scared. I'm not, I don't even have a fear of snakes, but I mean, you're out there purposefully trying to find snakes or trap snakes, or I mean, how does that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not trying to like, I'm not purposely trying to find 25-foot-long reticulated pythons, right?
I mean, so even like, if I saw a 3-foot snake.
What would you do?
Snake,
what would you do?
That's a good question.
I would be, I mean, as long as I knew that I was safe, right? Like there's multiple people around, whatever. I mean, you can
How does that make you
safe? How does that make you feel any better?
Well, because if there's multiple people around, then presumably they can help, you know, wrestle the thing off.
Yeah.
If, you know,
oh, did you see the video? Did you see the video of the, I don't know what kind of snake it was, you'll know, that wrapped around that dog and they beat the snake off of the dog and it let go of the dog eventually?
I haven't seen this video.
Oh.
Oh, wait, yeah. Yeah, yeah, maybe a couple years ago.
I follow this. I mean, I just saw it on. I follow all these different hashtags. Hashtag nature is metal. Hashtag nature is brutal. I love watching animals kill animals. It's like
cool.
The most fascinating thing in the world to me. But yeah, there was a snake that had wrapped itself around a dog.
How did they beat it off?
With like fucking sticks. And there's it's another language. I don't know what the hell they're saying.
Yeah.
And they're
and did the dog live? I can't remember.
The dog walked out. Yeah.
Yeah. So I did see this video, and I don't remember where it was filmed.
I mean, the dog, I don't know if the dog lived, but in the video it lived.
Yeah,
it
I don't remember where it was filmed. We certainly, like, so a bunch of these big snake species, so African rock pythons, certainly reticulated pythons, those are, and even boa constrictors here in the New World, like, those are species that are absolutely around human dwellings.
Yeah.
And there's lots of reasons for that, right? Like, where there's people, there's usually dogs, there's often cats, there's goats, there's sheep, maybe there's cattle. Like, there's a lot of potential prey items for these big snakes. And so, and it's also, I mean, let's face it, there's also, where there's humans, there's rats. Like, that's some sweet snake food.
That's an
and
easy
so,
get, yeah.
yeah.
Should so, have more snakes around.
We need more snakes in New York. That. That's what the New York subway needs, snakes.
Yep.
So you're going to see this, right? Like, and I remember that there's that video, and they, you know, whatever, they beat the poor snake, and the poor snake didn't get his meal.
The snake's the victim.
Totally. See, I remember they were beaten. I do remember the video, but mostly what I remember taking away from it was like, oh, the poor snake. Like,
I think they ultimately let this snake go.
I think they were just trying to let this dog go. Or they ended the video and then killed the snake, which is really cool.
I mean, they might have done that.
Yeah.
Do you have a pet snake?
I do have a couple pet snakes, yeah.
Whoa. You have two pet snakes.
I have three.
You have three pet snakes.
Yeah.
What are their names?
What kind of snakes are they?
So,
what do they eat?
So I'm 41. One of them I got when I was 15.
Wow.
So that one is named. His name is Audubon.
After the
painter naturalist.
Autobahn.
No. That's the freeway. That's the German highway system. Uh-huh. But
Otto.
A-U-D. So Audubon, A-U-D-U-B-O-N, is the painter naturalist.
Okay.
Man, so you're a smart 15-year-old.
Fucking nerd.
I had an Audubon book as a kid. Like the book. So he was this amazing painter, and I had this book of all of his paintings, and I would just sit there and like
flip through. What would he paint?
Amazing. Mostly birds. He was mostly birds, but did other stuff.
Snake prey.
I was very into Frank Netter. He's a artist of the human body. Like he does, he's drawn every organ, any human body. He draws all that shit.
You can name your next pet that.
Yeah. I'm going to name him Frank. Frank Netter.
There you go. I named that snake Audubon after the naturalist. And then my other two snakes, sadly, I got at a later point in my life where I was like, no longer felt the need to necessarily give them a name.
Mm-hmm.
I have an East African sand boa, which is just East African sand boa. I've never given her a name. And she's actually, I got her when she was 10 years old, and I got her in 1999.
Wow.
So
you don't like talk to her?
How do you know that's her age?
The person I got her from said he'd had her for 10 years.
Okay.
And when he got her, she was an adult. So this snake is like at minimum born in like 1985 or 86, possibly older than that.
Oh my
God. Like it's pretty long.
I want to hear about your third snake, but I also want to hear how old
the third snake is a thing called a Baird's rat snake, which was a species that occurs in northern Mexico and West Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular Baird's rat snake, I was out on a camping trip, and we got a flat tire.
Mm-hmm.
And this is in West Texas, and a utility vehicle went by us, like a utility van went by mm-hmm. us. We got the flat changed. We went up like 2 miles, and there's this snake that had been run over in the road.
Aww.
And it's this juvenile Baird's rat snake. At that point, it was about 2 and a half feet long. So, but it was moving. Like I picked it up. You know, I'm a museum scientist, and so this was when I was in grad school. I picked it up, and I thought, well, this thing's going to die. I may as well collect it and turn it into a museum specimen.
Wow.
But I didn't have any gear with me. No, I picked it up, and the thing was crawling all over the place, but it was literally gurgling up blood.
Aww.
And I could see that its jaw was broken, and I could see that it had a spot on its back that was broken. And so I didn't have any way to euthanize it and still have it, like, be a decent specimen. And so I had this debate of, like, what am I going to do with this thing? And I decided that, so that it wouldn't stress out, I would put it in a bag, and I would put it in this cooler. So literally, like, snake in a bag of ice, mm-hmm. like 12 beers in a cooler. We go on this canoe trip. We're away for like 36 hours. We come back. I check on the snake. And I was like, this snake was going to die within minutes, right?
Yeah.
And I open up the cooler. All the ice is melted. There's a snake in a bag, and he's looking up at me, and it's like the slowest tongue flicks you've ever seen because he's so cold.
Oh, no.
So I grab this snake. I throw him under my shirt so he can warm up.
Oh, my God.
And
bless you, sir.
And,
under your shirt.
And he's become super active. I put him into a dry cooler with some paper towels to see if he's still bleeding. He's not bleeding. I ended up.
What a resilient
little
rat.
I waited like 2 months. His jaw eventually slowly healed.
Wow.
I started feeding him. There's a non-native gecko.
Rewind. How did you know its jaw was broken?
Oh, you could see it. It was like clearly.
And what, it reset its own fucking jaw?
So snakes have like this amazing ability to kind of survive like incredible trauma. And so I just thought if it doesn't have to use its jaw for a couple months, and then if it doesn't have to use its jaw for anything like where there's a lot of force on the jaw for a while, like maybe it'll heal. So in Texas, there's these geckos called Mediterranean house geckos. I was in Austin at the time, University of Texas, Austin. And so I would just collect geckos and I would pinch off their tails.
Whoa.
And then I would feed the snake the tails because then he could just take them right off of a pair of forceps and swallow them right down without there being like, you know, much trauma to the jaw.
Wow.
So I did that for like, I don't know, 6 or 8 months.
Yeah.
And then eventually I got it to switch over to eating pinky mice. And which don't have any you know hair on them, so they're easy to swallow.
The snake was taking the tail from you willingly.
Yeah. Yeah.
I thought snakes want to eat things that are alive.
So, I mean, in general, yes, but I don't think the snake had much of a choice in what it was going to eat. And it, in the wild, they mostly eat lizards. And so I think it was happy to be like, oh, that smells good. I'll eat that.
I know that.
And it's certainly the case that in the wild, if you're going after a living lizard and you strike it and you end up grabbing the tail, that you know, the living part of the lizard, the body of the lizard, is going to just keep running off, right? Yeah. The lizard's going to live, and it's going to drop its tail. It's called autotomizing the tail.
Yeah. Oh, right,
so
right.
It's really common that snakes in the wild are just eating the tail. And so not a huge shock that it was like, oh, tail, that's fine. I can I'll totally eat this lizard tail. Yeah.
Okay, I have a few
So that snake is
here.
Also now, you know, I got that snake in 2001. That snake probably hatched in 98. So, again, you know, it's a 21-year-old. So his name, if he has a name, it's Lazarus for the obvious resurrection.
And what do you mean if it has a name? Like, how did you decide, oh, I'm not going to name these pets of mine? Because that seems like a really just common, like, of course I'm going to name my pet. It's my pet.
Yeah. I did that when I was younger.
But I'm saying.
So your girl.
Yeah, the Samboa. Yeah.
Why don't you just call her fucking Sandy or something?
Right.
Yeah, you could.
What, like. Do you talk to her ever?
Yeah, sure. You know, say hello.
Were you like, hey, Sandboa lady? Yeah.
Was it something where you felt like I'm going to get too attached if I give it a name?
No, I mean, I'm totally, they're great snakes. I like them.
Yeah.
I just don't have a need to name them.
Personifying this snake that you saved, like, huge, you know? I mean, like, that to me sounds like you saved a kid.
Does that snake know what you did for it?
Yeah.
Is it grateful, at least?
I don't know. It's never bitten me. It's always been very friendly. It's a great snake.
Yeah.
Sounds like a great snake.
I mean, if that snake doesn't love you, I'm going to be really just put off by snakes forever.
Well, then, just to convince you, yes, I'm sure it loves me.
Ah, that's nice.
Okay.
But no, in reality,
how old can snakes get?
So there are some records in captivity for certain species getting into the mid-40s.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So that's uncommon for most species. Like, Yeah, and in the wild, it's even lower, right? Yeah. So in captivity, we're like, living's pretty easy. There's like a ready supply of water. There's a ready supply of food. Mm-hmm. Like, sure, you can make it into the mid-40s with, you know, veterinary care at a zoo or something.
Yeah.
But for some of, like, the common species in the pet trades, like ball pythons and corn snakes, like, you know, hitting late 20s, early 30s is certainly not uncommon.
Wow. Cool.
And then for most wild snakes, like, getting up into, like rattlesnakes, for example, or gopher snakes, king snakes, getting even up into double digits is, like, quite the accomplishment. Yeah. Certainly rattlesnakes, like, 13, 14, 15 years is, like, not uncommon, but
Is there a reason they don't live as long?
Yeah, life is tough.
Life,
you know,
stuff.
They're getting
what
picked
predators,
off.
What predators? Birds?
So certainly hawks are taken out, lots of snakes. I mean, in our area, right? So like throughout much of, you know, like the U.S., like hawks are big predators. Mm-hmm. Other snakes are big predators. Mm-hmm. And then there's lots of mammals, right? Bobcats, mountain lions, coyotes.
Mm-hmm. Eating snakes up.
Are eating snakes left and right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
what if
one of those animals got bit by a rattlesnake?
Varies by species. So, like, some of them, like king snakes, for example, seem to have minimal effect from rattlesnake venom. Mm-hmm. Certainly other things, like, say, like a bobcat or a coyote, are absolutely going to be impacted by it. But they don't seem – you don't see the death rates in those species that you would expect given their body mass. Yeah. So they seem to be able to handle it better than, say, humans can.
Okay.
So they can metabolize the poison.
We don't totally know what's going on, but there's something like that going on.
It's crazy how much we don't know about these snakes.
Rattlesnakes.
We've like talked a ton about snakes, but like very little about this movie. I feel bad.
No, don't feel bad. This movie got plenty of attention. Apparently,
that's true. If it made three times what it cost to make,
yeah, I know.
Just fine.
It's absolutely unbelievable.
There are actually some things in the movie that they got right. Like, it's easy to like talk about the things that they got wrong because there's so many of them. Like the snakes are clearly too big.
Mm-hmm. Right.
The snakes are like eating way too much. They're not arboreal. You know, there's all these things that are wrong. Right. Mm-hmm. But like, one of the things that amazed me that they got right is, like, if you actually slow down some of the bite sequences and you look at the snake with its mouth open, they actually got the fact that snakes have these rows of teeth that are not just on the maxilla, so not just, like, sort of where you'd expect them to be, but they actually have another set of teeth that are inside that are on, like, basically, like, the top of the palate.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And it's on these bones called the palatine and the pterygoid. And, like, they actually got that right. Like,
yeah.
Snakes really have that. And they actually put in the palatine and the pterygoid teeth, which I was like, that is so cool.
Yeah,
that they got that right. Now, the weird thing is, like, depending on which scene you stop it at, sometimes they have teeth on the lower jaw, and sometimes they don't. And it's like, okay, that's weird. Like, why is it that just doesn't make any sense? But anyhow, but, like, they got that right, which I was
What about when the snake bit the dude's finger?
Oh, yeah.
I love that part when John Boyd was like, oh, they're such a...
they're young.
So this was like...
such efficient killers or something like that.
And having not seen the movie in 20 years, like, the one scene I really remembered was when they blew up that
dam of snakes and
that wooden dam.
Snakes flying.
And there's snakes everywhere.
Yeah.
And so the funny thing is, like, the snake that's actually on, what do we call that guy?
We called him Wit.
Yeah. So the snake that's biting Wit's finger is actually, like, I don't know if it's like CG or whatever it is. Like, it actually looks like an anaconda.
Oh.
Like, it actually had the right pattern for an anaconda,
which was
great. Like, that was positive.
Yeah.
But then John Voight's character, like, turns away and grabs this bigger snake that's, like, I don't know, 4 or 5 feet long, and he gets it and he throws it into the water, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's like, oh, go be with your mama.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Except that snake was a boa constrictor.
Yeah.
Which, like, does occur in that area, so, like, is a snake that actually could be, like, found there.
Yeah.
But in blown up in a dam or whatever. But, like...
Sure.
That's not...
By the way, are there a bunch of snakes just living in a dam?
I mean, a big wooden structure like that, you know, that's a good spot for, like, snakes to hang out. Yeah, sure.
Okay.
But, like, are there going to be 700 of those snakes in such a small area?
Yeah.
No, clearly not, you know.
Okay.
Like, I think about, you know, the, like, spots where I've seen large numbers of snakes, and it's rare, and it's usually things like, you know, it's like garter snakes around a pond. You know, maybe you get lucky if you see, like, 10 or 15 and... You know,
if you're
minutes.
Lucky, yeah.
Yeah.
Lucky.
Yeah.
But it makes sense that little baby would, like, eat your finger like that?
Because
he was bleeding,
like,
immediately.
Yeah, I don't know. That would not... I mean, no, it's not going to make much sense.
Okay, yeah, I would imagine, like, oh,
I
this
love
guy's
he's
probably
like, he's, like,
afraid.
So venomous or something like
yeah,
that.
There's
I was
some...
like, well, how come he's not dead?
Yeah.
Right,
not
yeah.
venomous. These guys are not venomous.
Not venomous, okay. I mean, I have a bunch of stuff here. I don't know what we've covered, what we haven't. Oh, I have a thing about financial reward for... a huge snake. Do you know about that stuff?
Yeah, actually initiated by Teddy Roosevelt.
That's right. Yeah, he offered $1,000 in the early 1900s.
Yeah.
And then it got all the way up. It kept raising the price for, like, these big snakes.
Yeah, it hasn't kept up with, like, the
rate of
inflation.
Wait, this is for real?
This
Roosevelt
is for real,
was, like,
yeah.
Roosevelt was, like, put a price on a snake?
So I think it's the,
snake.
Is it the, like, Bronx Zoo that did this?
Yes, yeah,
does
I think
it now?
Right.
And, like, and it's now the Wildlife Conservation Society. I think it's up to, like, 50 grand or something
Yeah,
like
it
that.
Said 50 grand, that's right, in 1980.
And is it for, it's for a 10 meter long?
I think it's, 30 feet.
It's 30, okay.
But nobody's done it. Nobody's ever brought it in.
Yep.
So
and I think, I mean, this is the thing, right? Is like, it's actually going to be reasonably measured. And so that's the problem, is like these claims to a snake that's like in even up into the mid 20s. You know, once you get above like, I mean, for an anaconda, once you get above 20, it's, I mean, once you basically get above 18, it's pretty much speculative. For a reticulated python, once you get above about 25 feet, that's like in there with the largest snakes that have ever been documented. And so even with that money and all of this effort, like, nobody's ever gotten anything even all that close to sort of that 30-foot mark.
Yeah,
so,
it would be cool.
Oh, it'd be,
if you could do that.
But if you think about, like, even back. These snakes that are, like, in captivity, kind of living a life of luxury, like, tons of food, you know, even those snakes are maxing out. I mean, the suggestions is that there's some that are in, like, the 24, 25, 26-foot range for reticulated pythons. But that's, again, those are living animals, not animals that have been carefully measured.
Right.
And what we see is that when these animals are carefully measured, suddenly they go from being 24, 25, 26 feet to being 4, 5, 6 feet smaller than that.
Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so I have a few potentially stupid questions. One of them is snake charming. I read that they don't actually respond to sound. And, okay, go ahead.
So, okay, so there's, like, lots of cool things going on with, like, snakes and sound. So, first of all, snakes don't have external ear openings.
Yeah.
Okay. And, in fact, the bone that in our ear, in our middle ear, the stapes, in snakes, that bone, that same, like, developmentally, the same bone actually is part of the jaw articulation.
Wow.
So, whereas we have, like, a single point where our jaw articulates, the snake's jaw articulation actually is composed of not just the sort of maxilla in the mandible, but actually this third bone. Mm. And so they actually have two points where the jaw is articulating on each side, which is why snakes
can detach.
Which is, no, there's no, that whole idea of, like, snakes can detach their jaws, like, nope, they don't detach their jaws at all.
Okay.
There are, just like in You know, just like an arm.
So it's just they have 2 points where the jaw can expand.
They can open up. They can just open up their mouths really broadly.
Okay.
And so because they have these 2 points of articulation, and so that's why you can get something like a near sort of 180 degree gape in some species of snakes. And so So, but the result of all this is like they can't hear in the way that we hear, right? Because they don't have these external ear openings. They don't have the same ear bones, but they are, you know, mostly on the ground.
So they can sense vibration.
Or they're in contact with some substrate. And so they can certainly sense vibration. They can sense things moving around.
And perhaps their tongue in the air can sense sound waves in the air.
Well, there's what we don't know is like a lot of aquatic animals have various ways of detecting movement in the water, like detecting like even like the movement of water, the movement of other things around them. And I think there's probably a lot of research that could be done on like the ability of snakes to detect that. That hasn't been well studied.
Okay.
So there's probably some other senses there that we don't know a whole ton about.
So how are they just detecting the movement then of this snake charmer and coming out?
Like, oh, so you're talking about for like when people are like people who are trying to charm snakes?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's so many things that are going on there. So in most cases, what we see with snake charming is that those animals are like on death's door. So they're probably not well fed.
Oh,
they're probably super dehydrated. They've oftentimes, for things like a lot of the cobras, they've actually had they're what we call venomoid. They've had the venom glands removed, or they've at least had the fangs broken off.
Oh, man.
And oftentimes
so
they've
sad.
Had their mouths sewn shut. So if you actually like look closely at like high quality photos of people who are charming snakes, you can oftentimes see some of the remaining sutures where their mouths have been sewed shut.
So how do the fucking snakes eat?
Yeah, exactly. So maybe
so cool.
So again, you're talking about animals that can go for months at a time.
Why doesn't PETA make videos about this?
Well,
PETA.
Not local. what we're seeing with snake charming is that it's not about the sound probably at all. They're probably looking at the movement.
Okay.
It's probably about the movement.
Crazy.
But it's also the case that they're probably not able to do anything to the person because they've had all these other things done to them.
Okay. Another like classic horror movie trope, mostly with sharks, or like when we talked about Lake Placid, I think, like blood in the water, and that like attracts somebody
how did
trying
they
to
not,
kill.
How was there not a piranha theme in Anaconda? Like
good
you've call. Got
yeah,
all this
totally.
Blood in the water, and then there's like never a piranha incident.
No, it's all like, snakes, baby.
He made a piranha joke at one point.
Yeah,
they
the
even have references, but like they never bring in the piranhas in the movie.
I think
like,
we need a piranha versus
totally
anaconda.
I love when he bled out when John Voight bled out the monkey and had that barrel of monkey blood and tosses it on him.
Right, but that's what I'm saying. Like, is that
so this idea of like scenting the prey on him?
Yeah.
So that's different. Like, what you're trying to do is I mean, it's weird to do it. It's actually really weird to think about doing it with blood. Like, there's totally not necessarily any point in doing it with the blood. Mm-hmm. What you should really do, like. A snake is not sensing the blood of its favorite prey item.
Mm-hmm.
A snake is like smelling that prey item. Like,
okay.
When we smell a cow, a living cow, we're not smelling steak.
No.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
We're smelling like barnyard.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So if you want to actually make something smell like a common prey item, you don't throw its blood on it.
Mm-hmm.
You take that dead animal, like if you think this thing eats monkeys, well, then take the monkey and rub them all over with the monkey. Make them smell like a monkey.
Monkey.
And then that's going to draw the snake towards it.
Yeah, I was confused about that. Because it's like, I don't know. I always see it with sharks, and I thought, oh, maybe they just thought, it's the same shit. Cover them in blood.
Yeah. I mean, sharks actually are detecting.
Right.
So that's the thing, right? Is that? But sharks feed in a totally different way. Like snakes eat. They're in general, this isn't true for every species of snake, but for almost every species of snake, the snakes eat the entire thing whole.
Mm-hmm.
And then the digestive tract will then basically the stomach then breaks it down, right?
Yeah.
And so they're not sensing the blood. They're thinking about what does this thing smell like from the outside? Therefore, what is it? Do I want to eat it? Yes, then they're going to eat it. But they're not thinking about like the blood.
But
sharks, absolutely, they're not just taking out things in the water, but like once they bite something and it falls into pieces, they're trying to like find those pieces, or they're trying to find like a dead whale or something else that's dead. So they're trying to, they're able to sense these other cues in the environment, like the smell of blood.
So snakes eat anything that's dead?
So some snakes will scavenge, some won't, but some will scavenge.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that common that they scavenge. So it's much more common that they're eating live animals.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay.
And like you can talk to people who keep snakes in captivity, and there are some species that it's really hard to get them adjusted to eating things like, you know, mice that you might buy frozen and then like thaw them out. Like some snakes are just like, no, I want to eat this thing alive.
Yeah.
I want it nice and warm and fresh. Like you get that.
I have another very stupid question. There's a point in the movie where the snake pops up out of the water and like spits out like projectile the monkey at somebody.
Yeah.
So I was just like, well, how did that happen? What is that?
Yeah. So we were talking about regurgitation a little bit earlier. So like the reasons that snakes regurgitate is if a snake eats a huge meal, then the challenge is that the snake, you know, like that 200-pound anaconda we were talking about earlier, if it eats a 100-pound capybara, like now it's a 300-pound animal that's trying to move around. And that's really hard. Like, that's a lot of mass.
So it'll digest some of it and then get rid of the rest.
No, what happens is if it's like a recent meal, like let's say it's been 2 days, 3 days, maybe even up to 4 days, hasn't digested that much, and some predator or some human starts messing with that snake. Sometimes then what they'll do is they will regurgitate that prey item so that then they're either better able to flee or better able to mount a defense. So that's the ways in which you see snakes regurgitate. And so the problem, of course, is that if they have to regurgitate something that's not going to go, that's basically meant for a one-way trip, right?
Yeah.
So like you see this sometimes with things like African rock pythons. They might take out some of these porcupines in Africa, like super spiny, and then you're trying, you
can't regurgitate.
That's a
one-way
meal. And so you get these situations where like these things get stressed out. They try to regurgitate this thing, and then they end up destroying, you know, end up basically killing themselves by trying to regurgitate.
They impale itself on a porcupine.
Porcupine's revenge.
Yeah.
That's actually good advice just for humans too. Like if you're stressed or like being robbed, you know, throw up.
If a man's chasing me through an alley and he's about to rape me, I'll just be like,
There's actually like,
come and get me.
If you think about this from the animal perspective, it's not a really common defense, right? Like lots of things will either poop all over you or puke all over you as a defense mechanism.
They tell women if someone's raping you to pee or poop on the guy.
Wow. Good advice, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, your options are limited.
Yeah.
Do what you
can. Do what you got to do.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Oh, the other one, the other stupid question was, and I know that this can't be true, but there's a few times in the movie where the snake will scream. It like lets out this like crazy shriek.
Oh, yeah. Do snakes make any sounds at all?
Okay. So this is like another one of the things that's related to a part of the movie that's actually, they actually show, which is that sometimes you'll see when the snake opens its mouth, there's this weird tube-like structure that kind of comes up from the floor of the mouth. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the glottis.
Okay.
And the snakes have that because if you're eating like a big meal, you sort of need, how do you breathe if it's going to take you like 2 hours to get some meal done?
Yeah.
And so that glottis, they can actually sort of stick out and kind of to the side a little ways and get just beyond that prey item so that then they can still get air while they're consuming something.
Mm-hmm.
And the top of that glottis often has a little cartilaginous ring. And so if they expel air quickly, it actually can produce a hissing sound. So like gopher snakes and bull snakes, which are this really widespread, it's a genus of snakes that occurs across much of the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's a species that actually, as part of its defensive display, will hiss.
Mm.
But like that's it. They can hiss.
Hiss. They're not. Yeah. That's it. There's no snakes ever going to be like.
There's no screaming.
Okay.
Yeah. But they can hiss.
There were some scary screams.
There were some screams that made no sense. Yeah. Actually, this is one of the species that I work on is a thing called the Koki frog.
Okay.
So I'm just thinking about sounds that were in the movie, and one of the things that was so exciting for me in the movie as I was watching it is that I always listen to like what do they dub into the movie the background swamp sound, and they actually dubbed in Koki frogs, which was kind
of
cool.
Can you do an impression of a Koki frog for us?
Koki, it actually says, it's called a Koki frog because it says Koki, like its call is Koki, but like much more pretty than I just gave
how
it.
Cute.
Oh, that's
and so
really
this
nice.
Is the species that in it's actually it's endemic to Puerto Rico, native to Puerto Rico, but was transported via the nursery plant trade to Hawaii. And it's the one that's like gone crazy in Hawaii and is causing problems in certain areas. It's caused like home prices to go down because it's so loud.
Whoa.
And it's caused a lot of the hotels have had problems because people are on their vacation and they're like, they get to this place and they can't sleep anymore because these frogs are calling all night long.
That's awesome.
Yeah, but they're native to Puerto Rico.
Why? What do they call for?
Oh, that's males calling to attract females.
Oh, fucking just so many horny dudes.
Just horny frogs, man.
I mean, you know, this is the reality, right? It's like if you're hearing birds call, if you're hearing frogs call, and like we'll all walk outside and we're going to hear birds call. And what are they mostly saying? They're mostly saying, hey, ladies, hey, ladies, hey, ladies, hey, ladies, hey, ladies.
Right.
So just so you know, when you're walking down the street and you're like, oh, these pretty bird sounds, that's 100% about sex.
Oh,
let's
God.
Just be clear about what's going on.
All men. Hashtag all men.
Yeah. Sorry, everyone.
So, I mean, there's more than that to it. It's like it's not just like attracting females. It's also like announcing territory ownership. Mm-hmm. But why are things announcing territory ownership? Well, that's to basically showcase their territory to the females. So anyhow. I was super excited that there was coquí frogs in the back. That's a Puerto Rican species. You can hear them in Puerto Rico. You can hear them in Hawaii. They're actually starting to get introduced to California. Mm-hmm. You can't hear them in the Amazon basin, but you can hear them in Anaconda.
Okay, very cool. And then I just wanted to give people like a heads up on snakes that might be in their area. I don't know if there's like a cute rhyme scheme for like, you know, black and yellow means they're mellow or whatever. Like, when should people look out for snakes and when are they like, oh, this snake is cool?
Yeah, so there is that. There is a rhyme. Okay. And it only works in the United States. Oh, okay. And so I don't even know what it is. Here's the answer. If you can't positively ID the snake and know exactly what it is, then don't mess with it.
That's
pretty easy.
I think
right?
As a general rule, just don't mess with snakes.
Yeah, I mean,
that's good.
Even for
that's
people like too. Me, like who study them, right? When I come across, like if I'm out hiking or mountain biking or something, I come across a snake, I don't just go pick them up.
Right.
Because
unless
they're injured, yeah. Why am I going to introduce like that stress to that animal's life? Yeah. Right? Like, why is it more important that I get to be like, oh, I picked up the snake. Like, let me take a selfie with it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Why is that more important than like recognizing that this is an animal that's like living its own life and we shouldn't introduce stress to its life? So like what I do is I watch them, you know, I just want to like,
check
what's it going to do? You know,
see
is it going to
do
some interesting behavior? Is it like looking for water? Is it looking for food? Like, what's it up to? Like you can watch it. Mm-hmm. So anyhow, it's spring right now. And so what I get every spring is I sort of get like calls from the media of like, oh my God, it's rattlesnake season. Like, what do we do? And this is, you know, it's, you know, why does the movie Anaconda do so well, right? It's because it plays off of people's
fears.
Inherent fears of snakes. Like same thing that these rattlesnake articles do. Where the reality, right, is that Anaconda is not a single documented human fatality.
Yeah.
In the United States, we have something like 7,000 to 8,000 venomous snake bites a year. Over half of those are because the person identified the snake and chose to interact with it. Uh-huh. So like,
douche.
Basically, that's your own darn fault. And then there's something like 5 to 6 human fatalities a year in the United States as a result of snake bites. So like, this is just not that big of an issue.
Yeah.
Cool.
Relative to like other things.
Do you feel less afraid of snakes now that?
I mean, still very much scared of snakes.
The way they move, does that freak you
out? I think they're fascinating. I'll watch a million videos about them.
So here's the thing. I think you should, like, you have, from an evolutionary perspective, you have every reason to be afraid of snakes. Mm. So mammals have this, you know, multi-million year history of evolving on a landscape with snakes in which we have been, in which we are eating snakes, we are prey to mammals as a whole, eating snakes, prey to snakes, also competing with snakes for food. Mm-hmm. So there's this great study done on reticulated pythons based on a bunch of interviews done in the 70s. It actually was one of the like first really solid studies to document regular predation of pythons on people. And this happens to be for a group called the Agta Nigrida, which like adult males are like roughly right around 100 pounds and like 4.5 feet tall. So, you know, smaller than what most people are in this country. But this was a sort of royal hunter-gatherer community. Mm-hmm. And in this particular group that they were interviewing, 26% of adult males had predatory bites from reticulated pythons.
Mm-hmm.
And there were 6 documented fatalities sort of in the history of this community, like within the last couple of generations. Okay, that's just for what we have right now, right? But if you think back to like 4 million years ago, 5 million years ago, where our lineage, you know, is smaller, is also in Africa, different suite of snakes, a lot more venomous snakes. Our evolutionary history is about, it's a history of being on a landscape with snakes and certainly being prey to snakes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it makes sense that we would have an inherent fear of snakes. Yeah. It's like, fear of snakes to me, it's like, yeah, that evolutionarily, that makes sense.
It requires us to keep us alive.
Fear of heights. Like, I get it. That makes sense. Like, you're like claustrophobic. You don't want to go in caves. Not necessarily unreasonable. Like, you know,
scary
not
stuff
a place that you can easily see. And like, you're putting yourself in places that you can't easily like mount a defense or run away. Like, those are reasonable fears. There's the vast majority of people's fears are like totally unreasonable.
But
you want to be scared of snakes? Like, that's fine. Now, you want to be scared of snakes? Fine. But then when you see a snake, don't then be like, oh, well, the right thing to do is kill it. No, you're afraid of snakes. Like, just leave the area. Like, let the snake be. Like, it's totally fine.
Stop killing snakes.
Yeah, stop killing snakes. Totally not worth it.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And we already know that the vast majority of snake bites come from people choosing to interact with snakes.
Yeah.
So,
like, if I'm just walking on a trail, like, no rattlesnake's going to fucking lunge out of nowhere.
Yeah, so this is the thing, right? Like, no, they're not. Like, they don't chase you. They basically,
they aren't sitting there waiting for me to walk by.
No, and but they are waiting for a rabbit to go by. They are waiting for a deer mouse to go by. They are waiting for a kangaroo rat to cruise by, right? Like, they are waiting for a prey item. And if you are out wandering around in places where there are snakes, like, it's pretty easy. Just don't put your hands, don't put your feet places where you can't see.
Right.
And then if you see something like a rattlesnake, it's really easy what you do.
Walk away.
Well, yes, but before you walk away, you pull out your phone and you take a picture of it.
Yeah.
Like, and the reason I say that is because...
You send it to someone.
No, you send it into this wonderful website called iNaturalist, which is actually this amazing community science platform where people can upload photos of wildlife and plants that they see. Mm-hmm. And then scientists like me actually use those observations for asking various research questions. So, like, I use this here in Los Angeles as a way to take modern-day observations, compare them to historical museum records, and then understand how species are responding to urbanization, like how are their ranges shifting in response to urbanization.
Okay.
And all those modern records come from basically people's cell phones.
iNaturalist.
iNaturalist, yep.
Can I upload, because I was just hiking in Red Rock outside of Las Vegas, and I saw this staining.
Don't tell me you saw a Gila monster, because I'm just going to be too jealous.
No. I didn't see any animals. I just saw staining on rocks. There was a stain on a bunch of different rocks in a certain area.
But like not like a pictograph, not like Native Americans.
No. It was an environmental, I don't know what it was. It was a mineral deposit on a rock. Mm. And I was like, what is this?
Yeah. So iNaturalist is specifically for
animals,
living organisms.
Okay.
Gotcha.
But any fungus,
okay,
plants, animals.
Okay.
There are probably also websites out there that focus on like geological features,
okay,
but that's, I just don't know them.
Okay.
Cool.
But this iNaturalist site is like,
oh, cool,
truly changing the way that biodiversity scientists
I'm
do
assuming
research,
they're probably on Instagram posting some of these cool things.
Oh yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm into this.
Yeah. And great. I actually harvest photos off of Instagram, like for particular things that I'm interested in studying.
Yeah.
I might take photos off of Instagram. Like maybe it's like predator prey interactions or interesting behaviors. I might find those on Instagram and use those in research as well.
Follow Nature is Metal.
Okay, Instagram. That's a good one.
Yeah, I follow. There's so many cool animal interactions. Yeah.
Well, this leads us perfectly into our little plug section here at the end. Obviously, you have your book out right now. People can purchase on Amazon and
So people
wherever
who are in the LA area, there's this new book, Wild LA, Explore the Amazing Nature in and Around Los Angeles. Just came out in the last couple of weeks. I think it's a great book for people. I mean, obviously I'm biased. Of course, I think it's a great book. No, I think it's a great book for people that are living in this area, that are like excited about nature or thinking about getting excited about nature. But I think it's also a great book for people who are thinking about visiting LA. It's got 101 species accounts, 25 recommended trips. So it's kind of a trip planner as well. So
cool. Yep, and people can check out the Natural History Museum.
And people can check out, people absolutely can check out the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County, as well as the La Brea Tar Pits and Museum. If you are coming to visit LA, you should absolutely check out both of those places. The La Brea Tar Pits is the world's best Ice Age fossil site, and it literally sits on Wilshire Boulevard. Like, that's completely ridiculous and amazing, and you should check it out. And come check out the Natural History Museum. And wherever you are, you should start taking photos and uploading them to iNaturalist.
Great. Awesome. Nicole Schreiber.
Hello. Let's see. My podcast, Getting to Know You.
Mm-hmm.
It's a social experiment podcast where two human beings get to know each other only on a podcast.
Great.
So if that's your sort of thing, we don't really have that many guests. We try to have guests from our life. So if you're into that sort of thing, it's like you're eavesdropping on two humans getting to know one another.
Sounds fun.
And then I do stand-up comedy here in Los Angeles and around the country. So come see me. I post my shows on my Instagram. I'm bad at updating my website. Try to get better at that. When does this podcast come out?
I'm not sure. Could come out tomorrow. Could come out next week.
Okay. Come see shows. I'm at the Comedy Store at least 2 to 3 nights a week. So.
Great. Where can people find you on
Instagram? Oh, social media, at Nicole Amy, NicoleAimee. That's Twitter, Instagram, Facebook.
Great.
And that's my website as well. So.
Wonderful. Well, cool. I very much enjoyed our conversation here today. Thank you both. Thank you, Nicole. Thank you, Greg.
Thanks for having us.
And I'll see you next time when we do Python versus Submarine Snake.
Oh, yeah. A movie that nobody could find, but an amazing movie, Fair to Lance.
Fair to Lance. Okay, perfect.
Great. All right. See you.
All right. Bye.
Bye.
Oh, my God. Snakes.
Bad Science is hosted and produced by me, Ethan Edinburgh. Our social media producers are Kate Baker and EJ Gullett. And the executive Balserano Deucer is Brett Kushner. Mateo, No, nobody's name Mateo that works on the team. Anyways, follow us on Instagram at Bad Science Show. That's at Bad Science Show. You can send us an email at badscience@seeker.com. And please rate us and review us on iTunes. That helps us grow, lets other people know about the show. And next week, we'll be talking about The Avengers, 2012's The Avengers. So watch that if you haven't. And I'll see you next week. Bye.